Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And before we get started, I want to remind you that KBOO is funded by you, the listener. So please show your support for this amazing community resource by making a contribution today, or better yet, becoming a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. This year's Oregon legislative session has been another wild ride. There were more bills introduced this session than ever before, an interesting mix of vital bills addressing environmental, social, and racial justice issues, and a rash of other bills to undo all that. While many of the worst bills and some of the best have wound up in the dustbin of history for now, many others are still wending their way through committee hearings on their way to a final vote. To guide us through this legislative maze, today we talk with Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters about the good, the bad, and the truly awful of this year's legislative session. Julia, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thanks for having me.
And I would say that probably the worst, truly bad stuff that's going on right now is that the Republicans in the Senate have fled, or more or less fled, the Capitol again. For this is like the third time in a row, right?
Yeah, third or
fourth,
I think, actually. Well, the thing is, they haven't actually fully fled the Capitol. They're just not showing up to floor votes.
They aren't in, like, Boise or anything like they were a couple of years ago.
No, they're in the building. They're just not taking votes. It's wild.
So I think before we get into the strange dynamics of that, I wanted to talk about the bills. I want to talk about what we were going to talk about before the Republicans left the Senate and look at what the array of bills is and the best ones that should be supported and the ones that you're working on to defeat.
Okay, sounds good.
So let's start. What's your favorite bill?
Oh, God, what's my favorite bill? I didn't know that's how we're going to start. Don't make me choose my favorite child. Goodness. And I guess I should also offer a quick correction. Some Republicans are like, out. They're not showing up. But there's enough that are in the building. The bills are still moving through committees and things like that. They're just not doing floor votes.
And there's also, aren't there two Republicans who are actually still coming to Senate if the Senate was actually meeting?
Yeah. There's and yeah, exactly. A couple of Republicans who have really important seats in tight districts, I think. So, yeah.
And they want to get reelected in 2 years.
And they want to get reelected. Yeah, they've been prioritized by their party as needing that reelection. So, but yeah, they seem very, very committed to challenging the ballot measure that so many people supported.
That is the people who are fleeing the Senate right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, the folks who are not showing up to do their jobs.
Well, we'll talk about that later. It reminds me, it has a little bit of a tone of Trumpism about that, about what their hopes are there. So we'll talk about that at the end of the show.
But yes.
But let's now get to want it to be your favorite bill, but your favorite bills.
Yeah, so I mean, I think every year, so I work in the environmental sector, so I'm going to kind of focus on environmental bills that I really care about. I will say that the bills that the Republicans walked out over on a personal level are very important to me. Abortion rights and gender-affirming care, yes, please and thank you, you know.
And gun control. Too.
And the other one is gun control. And also, yes, please and thank you to that, too. So, I mean, those two bills are huge, and it's really disgusting to shut down the government and our ability to do anything. And I think I guess we're going to talk about the walkout later, but those bills are really, really important. And I think to shut down the government over those two bills is really disgusting. However, you know, working in the environmental sector, we have a lot on the line in terms of climate. Climate is, you know, the existential crisis of our time. It is a very, very big issue. And there is a suite of bills called the Resilient Buildings Bill Package. And it's kind of the big next thing on climate that we're getting done. And we really are getting it done. There's been a year-long task force that worked to get this suite of bills ready to go. And because of that incredible work, they're just moving. I mean, if it weren't for the Republican walkout, those bills would be happening and they would be funded. And those bills are going to do so much to ensure that people, every income level, have energy efficient homes that are weatherized, that are safe, that, like, you know, when we have these extreme weather events, whether it's extreme hot or extreme cold weather, that you have like a heat pump that's really efficient, that is going to keep your house a safe temperature and like really good insulation. And it sounds like really unsexy stuff, but it's like, this saves lives when you have like, you know, energy efficient homes with energy saving appliances, and also keeps your bills down, right? So it's just, there's so many benefits to this like suite of bills. I don't know if I have to walk through every single bill and what each
actually, one
of them
does. Actually, we did a show about it a few weeks ago, so you
exactly.
don't need to get the details. One of the things that was brought up in that show was that there's this huge pot of money from the feds
yep.
that is now or never.
Yep.
And so that's one of the concerns about getting this bill passed.
Well, and that's like, that was going to be my next thing that I was going to say, is simply that rather than picking my favorite bills, the thing I'm, is again, like I work on so many issues, so I'm kind of wonky and dorky about these things, but it turns out the other thing that I'm really, really passionate about is the budget and the bills that we want to pass that can help us compete for federal money, for really incredible projects for carbon sequestration, for these green buildings, for renewable buildings, for there's a green bank idea that's really incredible. There's like so many things we could be doing, and there's so many programs that are going to come, you know, get additional funding or new programs that need to come into existence in order to compete for federal funding that all happen because of bills that need to pass. And additionally, just like the budget itself, we have a whole bunch of state agencies doing really incredible work. And they've got DEQ doing really important air quality work that's really important for public health and also for just like businesses to like function and be compliant with like our laws. And like none of that happens if we don't have people doing their jobs in the legislature. So the budget is huge.
Actually, DEQ is one of the majorly underfunded and understaffed agencies in the state, and it has a huge job ahead of it because it's supposed to be the agency that's going to manage the compliance of fossil fuel industries in the critical energy infrastructure hub as they have to come into compliance mm-hmm. with seismic safety rules. That was a bill that was passed last session, last year. Mm-hmm. And so if DEQ doesn't have the staff to be able to manage that, this bill that was passed last year is going to mean nothing because the fossil fuel industries can just fudge their way through it again.
This is the classic problem in Oregon. I don't want to say it doesn't matter. It totally matters who your elected officials are and how, from my perspective, how progressive they are really matters. But if you have the political will to pass something good that's going to, you know, help make things better for people, but you don't have a state with revenue streams to pay for it, then it's really hard. Our state is so full of unfunded mandates and programs that we had the intent to implement, but not the resources to actually follow through. And so that's always where the rub is, honestly, is not just getting these difficult, often like challenging to get over the finish line bills, but then it's finding the resources for them. And in this year, because of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, we have literally billions of dollars on the line that we could be competing for. They would bring tons of jobs and improve quality of lives for people in rural Oregon. These investments are very beneficial to the rural parts of the state. It's not just for the Portland metro region at all. And they're just leaving it on the table by not coming back. Yeah.
Now, are there other bills or ideas in this session to raise revenue? It seems that there's issues about taxation. And one of my senses about Oregon taxation is that it taxes low-income people too much and high-income people too little.
So in order to change taxes, way back in mini history lesson, everybody, I don't know exactly when this happened, but when there was a Republican majority in the state legislature.
Back in 1990, I think.
Was it in the 90s?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was a child at the time. Anyway, the Republicans, I remember when this happened, though. My parents were very upset. When they passed a law saying that you need 3/5 vote to pass any kind of tax in the state of Oregon. And even with a supermajority,
And we have a supermajority.
For like a hot second.
A Democratic supermajority.
We had a Democratic supermajority for a hot second, and we still couldn't get it done. But because, you know, like the Democratic Party is not a monolith, you know. But anyway, it's just like, and we had that supermajority for like a very small period of time. And let's not forget that part of that supermajority was Betsy Johnson, who ran for governor as an independent. So like, you know, this is what we were dealing with. And I feel like for the longest time, we were like not able to like really call that out, but we call it out now.
It's good now. Actually, I'm glad that Betsy Johnson's gone.
Yeah, she was really in the right direction.
She showed her true colors when she ran for governor. No, it was kind of interesting. Sure. In Portland, there was an effort to get a measure that would increase the capital gains tax. Mm-hmm. And this is in a Portland ballot that just failed a couple weeks ago. And there was a lot of arguments about whether that ballot measure was clearly written, how if it was going to really increase taxation on lower income people and not really hit the wealthy. And there were a lot of lies that were spread by its opponents. But there's a concern about capital gains taxes. And that was one place where I wondered, does Oregon itself have an adequate capital gains tax that actually taxes the wealthy but leaves the lower income people untouched?
I mean, I think we absolutely need to and should be exploring ways to increase taxation of the wealthiest folks to help pay for things. But I don't know if you remember this, but I forget, a few elections ago, we tried to pass a ballot measure as well that would increase the corporate tax, because we have one of the lowest, if not the lowest, corporate tax in the nation. It was like lower than Idaho. And they're like, oh, they're going to like flee Oregon. I'm like, our neighbors have higher corporate tax. What are you talking about? You know, and so, and the fear tactics on that, they're like, your cereal and your milk is going to get more expensive. They're going to pass that on to the consumer. And just a lot of really nasty rhetoric, you know, made it so we couldn't even increase the taxation of corporations in our state. It's like our state really, really struggles with revenue. Honestly, I think it's one of our biggest challenges. It's like you can have all the political will you want to pass really great bills, although we need to work on that too. Do not get me wrong there. But, you know, it's a big issue that we're going to have to continue working on collectively if we want to be a state that can, you know, when you rely so heavily on income tax, that's a very volatile number given what, you know, whether or not people are employed, whether or not, you know, people are getting paid enough, right? You know what I mean? That number changes depending on the economics of what's going on. And it's just, we just don't have a very diversified. So anyway, I don't have the solution here. I'm not telling us what to do. But yeah, I think, you know, taxing, you know, if you look back in the 1970s, it's not that long ago, we taxed wealthy people at a much higher rate than we do now. And it was fine.
I saw an article in the Oregonian the other day that Oregon now has the highest percentage of high income people in the highest income bracket than ever before. So what does that mean? I mean, so there's all these wealthy people we could tax. Why aren't we, if they're in the highest, is it just that the highest income bracket tax rate is still so pitifully low, it's not really making much difference?
I don't know. But all I know is that, like, I feel like this is a national problem too, right? We just don't tax.
One of the things that's come up periodically is, well, we need to have a sales tax in Oregon. Oof. And I remember, I think in my time, I've been here for like 52 years, and I think I've seen three sales tax measures, at least on the ballot. The first two I bitterly opposed because I lived in a state where this is back in the 70s and 60s, where the sales tax at that time was like 7%. This is New York State. And I know even going up to Washington, which I have done a lot since I've lived in Oregon, and there's quite an onerous sales tax there too. And of course, Washington State has no income tax, so it's really retrogressive tax. But the last time it was on the ballot, I actually voted for it because it was like, how do we fund the schools? And it didn't pass, and I was kind of relieved in a way. But it seems like we're looking at all the wrong things. And yeah. I'm wondering, before we move on to things that are more in your area of expertise, how do we need to look at diversifying our revenue? Because obviously sales tax alone isn't going to do it, as Washington State proves, and income tax alone isn't going to do it.
I mean, I will say that Washington State has a much easier job of passing bills and funding them than we do, though. They are in a better place than we are in terms of revenue. You can have a debate about how equitable or fair that is, but, you know, of the West Coast states, we struggle the most to raise money to do even just the basics. And it's because, and so I think it's what we've been talking about. It's about trying to get a better breakdown on the tax bracket so you're getting more money from the wealthier people and not from the lower income folks. I think it is increasing taxes on corporations. I think those are things that we could actually stomach as people. I think that the sales tax is a non-starter because we keep trying and it fails. I mean, people said that about reforming the city charter, and eventually, obviously, people saw how broken the commission form of government was, and like that, and we voted to change it. So I mean, maybe that's changeable. But like, all I don't really have like the perfect solution, but I do know that we have a pretty challenging scenario in the state of Oregon to actually do the things that need to be done and provide for the people in this state the way they deserve to be provided for, and protect the environment and do all the things we want to do. in the revenue situation that we have right now. It's hard.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KPFM Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters about the good, the bad, and the truly awful of this year's legislative session. Well, before we get to the really, truly awful, which we'll get to in a moment, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the resilient building bill. Now, does that look like, I mean, when we talked about it on the show a month ago, it was looking very promising, and it was going through the committees in the House. Has it since been, has it actually been passed by the House yet?
Those bills needed to go through, I'm trying to remember where they're at exactly. Did they pass the Senate already? Is that?
See, I don't know about that either. I remember they got, I think they had to go through Ways and Means. It already been
through. They're in Ways and Means. That's it. Okay, sorry, my brain. So yes, we have bills in Ways and Means. It's a package of four bills. There's kind of a fifth bill that is ancillary but helpful that came from the House. They all have fiscal, which means they all have cost associated with them. They are going to cost money in order to, you know, weatherize people's homes and increase energy efficiency and all those things. So they're kind of languishing in Ways and Means right now. And I would say that if everyone was in the building and things were being voted on and stuff was moving, those bills would be in a very good place. Those bills solidly fall in the category of something that would be done and funded. We could all have a debate about whether or not it's funded enough, but you know, those bills were on a very clear path until the walkout.
So let's talk a bit about the walkout. Now, you mentioned that the walkout is specifically about three areas of concern for the Republicans. This seems to weigh more than whether people die during heat domes, and that is that they're concerned about abortion rights. That they're concerned about the services and facilities for and the acceptance of transgendered people.
Yep.
And they're concerned about they're taking their guns away. So, but meanwhile, there's all this collateral damage. And I'm not sure, I'm wondering, I know that 2 years ago, the walkout had a lot to do with climate bills.
Right.
So this year, the climate bills aren't on the table.
That's what I think is so amazing. So this is where we're really lucky. Lucky is the wrong word. We were smart and we did really important work collectively as a state. It was very clear from polling that Oregonians from every walk of life, Republican, Independent, Democrat, everyone, by and large, mass majorities of people think walkouts are wrong. They think that you should show up to your job. No one else gets to not go to their job and keep their job. This is like, we elected you to serve. And so we passed a ballot measure that instead of just completely preventing walkouts, it allowed for there to be up to 10 unexcused absences. And then after that, if you exceed 10 unexcused absences, you can't run for reelection. So it's not even like you're instantly kicked out. You just can't run for reelection. So this is the first session we've had since that law was passed by overwhelming support from voters. And the Republicans in the Senate specifically have decided that they want to challenge the legality of that law. If you look at the behavior and the outcomes of the behavior, they're just overtly like anti, they're very comfortable with shutting government down, with breaking government. I mean, it's very clear. They don't really care if it works.
You know? Well, that seems to be the general tone of the Republicans across the country, because that's what we're seeing happening right now with this debt ceiling debate. Yeah. It's like, I mean, I think some of the Republicans are finally being pulled back into line, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and some of the other idiots, in terms of don't talk openly about it's okay to destroy the government. It's okay to destroy the country.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like, so I mean, and I think that a really important response to a couple of days, well, more than a couple of days ago, I guess at the beginning of last week, the messaging coming out of the Republicans, you know, is daily, right? Because they have a lot of time on their hands to, like, you know, come up with whatever message they want to be feeding, you know, reporters. But, you know, early last week, they were like, oh, we'll come back on the last day of session to pass a budget, as though, like, passing a budget alone without the policy bills is enough. And I'm like, no. Like, if you look at all the bills that would languish on the vine, that would just not pass, you look at how the budget is structured, it needs policy bills to pass in order for things to get funded, because the policy bills create the programs that you put the money into, right? I mean, it's just wacky.
So these guys don't seem to know how government works, which is what's true in Washington.
Or they know how it works, and they really, I mean, I think you look at somebody who just announced his presidency, his run for presidency, Florida governor, and he pretty overtly is smart about trying to like dismantle government while being part of it. It's wacky. But anyway, I would just say that it's a pretty big gamble in my mind. I don't know what the end game here is because whether you want to run for statewide, it just seems like a very strange platform to build your brand on walking out when you know that voters don't like it. So I'm just like, good luck with that. I mean, it seems like they're more concerned about the short-term outcome of stopping what they perceive as bad bills at any cost, regardless of how much it hurts Oregonians.
Well, you mentioned before that they are going to challenge the law.
Mm-hmm.
So I read in the Oregonian that some legal experts said, like, fat chance.
Right.
So it felt to me a little bit like Trump trying to challenge some of his lawsuits.
Oh, yeah.
And basically just say witch hunt and fake news and stuff like that. So what are they going to achieve? As it sounds like, I think they're not going to be able to run for reelection. And some of them are up next year. So I just wonder, these guys are actually willing to risk their political careers on this?
Well, and that's why we're expecting there to be like two or three, Republican senators who were like maybe older, who really were maybe done, testing it out just to, give it a shot. I think they were getting advice. I mean, I don't know. I mean, but it feels like there's some amount of hubris or, overconfidence that they can win. I think that something else to keep in mind is it does create uncertainty and a delay tactic when there's multiple lawsuits on multiple issues. That also might be part of why there's so many of them. Maybe they're all going to have different challenges, different parts of the law. I don't know. But I mean, I think it's just they're not overly concerned about a functioning government. And the longer that there's uncertainty and the more that they can point to dysfunction that they're creating, more that it makes life challenging for the Democrats, right? So I really think that it is about that. It's about just sowing uncertainty. And so I think that that's why there are many people who are starting to really consider coming at this from a whole new angle. It's like, we could have done this the last time, but maybe we need a ballot measure that just
gets rid of the quorum.
Gets rid of the quorum, and that's like, because that's the issue here.
Actually, let's just explain that for people, especially if you've just moved to Oregon and you're wondering what's going on. You haven't been through this for the last 6 years. Why is it that when the Republicans flee the state capitol, that business can't go on?
Yeah, so Oregon requires through our constitution that there be a quorum, a certain like percentage of legislators present in order to pass bills in order to vote. And rather than get rid of quorum requirements altogether, this last ballot measure decided to keep the quorum requirements of percentage, which is more than 50% plus one. It's like it's too many, right? And so if they get rid of the quorum requirements, it means those who choose to show up to work get to legislate. You know what I mean? And that's like, so the quorum requirement, it just... Because the way it's – and I'm going to be totally honest. I mean, this is very similar to how the United States Senate came into existence. The less populated southern states really wanted to make sure they were represented well in the American government. And, Eastern Oregon and rural Oregon really wanted to make sure that the less populated parts of the state had a lot of power. And I think that's how this got baked into the Constitution. But it's like, this is the tyranny of the minority at this point. When you have a minority party willing to shut down the entire functioning of government, this quorum issue. So anyway, we'll see what happens. But I think that folks are, voters have made it very clear they expect their elected officials to show up to work. And if this mini walkout that, is still sanctioned, which is you can be gone for up to 10 days if you really want to make a statement. But if they're going to abuse that privilege too, then maybe it's like voters, I just don't think are going to have a high tolerance.
In the short term, I would certainly support a ballot measure to amend the Constitution to get rid of the quorum. I also think that there should be stricter penalties And perhaps it shouldn't be that you can't be reelected. That's like you get expelled. I mean, it seems like it would be a reason to be expelled from. And then, of course, I wonder what would happen if you expelled all these people, then we wouldn't have a quorum.
Right, right. I think, I imagine that's probably why it was drafted the way that it was drafted, was that as long as you're going to, yeah. So anyway, either way, it's like and anybody who walked out and doesn't have an election this upcoming year means we have a whole nother short session next year with a number of Republicans who are lame ducks, right? Who have proven they don't really have any investment in the system working. And it just makes us all very, as a person who works at the legislature, it's all very nerve-wracking and very frustrating.
Well, I mean, I think we better see some ballot initiatives happen really quickly before the next session. I'm not sure that's possible, actually.
Well, I do think there was an analogy that I heard in a meeting a few days ago that I thought was like really good. It does feel like it's working. The ballot measure is working in that Democrats are holding strong. They're not making concessions. But the thing is, it's kind of like when you punish your kid, you take away their like iPad or whatever, and now they're going to be really obnoxious for a whole week, and they're going to be really irritating. But you're like, no, you need to learn this lesson, and we are both just going to suffer through this punishment, right? And it's kind of a little bit like that, where it's like everyone is going to hurt, which is not cool. I mean, Oregonians more so than anyone, it's not okay. But it's like, you know, it's like they have to, they're testing the new law, and we fully expect the new law to stand up and to stand strong. But it's the amount of time and the damage that can be done in the interim that's like so difficult. You know what I mean? But it's just like, I think this is very, very different than previous walkouts in terms of the strength of the Democrats, which is different.
Let's talk about, because you brought it up a little bit in the beginning, how are the Democrats responding to this differently than they did in the last 3,000 walkouts, but in ways that maybe can get some bills actually passed that are right now in limbo?
You know, this is a hard question to answer just because I feel like every day you hear different information and it's hard to know what's real versus not real, and information changes over time. But the gist of it is, there's like, I think kind of like three things at play. Even the Republicans were like, we will consider passing strongly bipartisan bills. And it's like, well, there's a lot of really important bills that frankly should be bipartisan if they cared about
the future of the planet.
About people dying in their homes from heat, you know, events, right? You know, and so, but all of that said, I think that Democrats are doing a few things really smart. The House is still fully functional, everyone, by the way. Everyone's showing up to work in the House and voting. So the House is just is going to move as many bills as they possibly can, get them as far along the process as they possibly can, so that we can show everyone and tell a story about, like, this is what was left on the table if they don't come back. And then if they do come back, we're fully prepared to be like, all right, we are going to pass, the bills that really, really matter. You know what I mean? And if we can't, if they're like going to like not let us, you know, pass important policy bills, then it becomes the really, really hard question of, well, then, you know, we're just going to do a special session for budgets and some pretty narrow bill packages, I think, is how that would end up going. And then a lot of work is cut out for us in the next short session to try to pick up all of the missing pieces. I know there is talk about trying to get like some large, like omnibus bills that will include dozens of policies in different areas, like, you know, one for education, one for like environment and climate, one for public health, like, you know, and then these bill packages are kind of like ready to go if and when Republicans decide they want to show up and do their jobs, right? So I know that Democrats are doing a lot of things to be nimble and be ready to move as quickly as possible when and if they come back. But what is clear is they're not making these big trades. They're not like letting the big important thing like die for the sake of getting them back, right? You know, unfortunately, because of how they're behaving and shutting everything down, I don't know what the path is for the bills that they walked out on. And that's like really, really upsetting, you know, that the default is that they may not be able to get done. And that's just gross. But that's not a Democrat fault issue.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on Cape Breton Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters about the good, the bad, and the truly awful of this year's legislative session. We'll just finish off with what I consider to be the most truly awful thing, which, again, is this Republican walkout. I'm curious if you think the difference in governors has made any difference in the way that the Democrats are facing this with more strength, unity, and resilience than they have in the past, and why the Democrats haven't caved on a whole bunch of issues.
I think it's a little bit hard to tell if that's a governor thing. It's hard to tell if that's a governor thing or if that's the ballot measure thing. I will say, and it's only her first term, right? It's her first legislative session as governor, and she'd been elected like nanoseconds before it started, and it's just like a lot. I will say she had been Speaker of the House until very, very recently. She's worked really closely with all of the people who are in leadership and running the legislature right now, which also has relatively new leadership as well. I mean, Speaker Rayfield only had one term under his belt prior to this, and it was Senator Wagner's and first time being Senate president, and Senator Lieber's first time being majority leader in the Senate, and Julie Fahey, Representative Fahey, I think it's her second term. No, she's been majority leader longer than that, but it's a lot of new leadership. All I've got to say is, from what I can tell, it does feel like there's a lot more coordination. I mean, sometimes like the legislature is kind of has tension with the governor, and there's always going to be tension, you know, some tension between the two entities. But I feel like when it comes to this, like the governor, and when it comes to the Republican walkout, she's deeply involved, and it seems like not giving an inch. And that's, I think it's, and that, and they're all seem to be on the same page with that. So I think it's, you know, it's not her first rodeo in terms of Republican walkouts.
That's definitely true. Well, it was interesting that early on in the walkout, I think it was like going to be day 9, they suspended, I'm not sure if she or if the Senate leadership suspended the session. They stopped meeting officially for 3 days, kind mm-hmm. of a cooling off period,
yeah,
hoping to get the Republicans back. That didn't work. But I thought that was an interesting move, because that's something that they didn't do. Well, they didn't have reason to do it before the ballot measure.
Right.
Do you think that had any effect at all?
I think the effect that it has is, at the very least, you can tell the public, and it's clear to the public, that the Democrats are doing everything they can to bring the Republicans back and to make the government work, whether or not they are willing to meet those expectations is on the Republicans. But I think that it was like, I think it's important to demonstrate that you're doing everything you can to get them back without, you know, as they say, negotiating with terrorists, right? We're not going to like give on like the fundamentals, but like we, you know, I think there was a really earnest effort. And it also shows the hand of the Republicans. Like, it's like, it seems like their goal is not simply just to stop their perceived bad bills from moving. They seem very, very, very comfortable with losing their own bills. I mean, they're very comfortable with like really damaging and the government and making it not functional. And it's just, it really makes you, we're showing their true colors. And voters are going to have a lot of information to work with when they make decisions moving forward about how to handle the situation with these leaders.
Well, I find it very interesting to see this going on at the same time that we're dealing with the great drama of the debt ceiling crisis.
Oh, yeah.
And there, again, I'm actually reading this book right now by this guy, Robert Draper, called Weapons of Mass Delusion, sort of how the Republican Party went crazy or insane. And really learning more about some of these, the leaders of the crazies in the Republican Party and just how crazy they really are. And it's been sort of alarming to be reading this while watching the debt ceiling crisis and also watching the Republicans in Oregon. And it does seem that the Republican Party is just dominated now by people who just want to destroy things. It's like the Steve Bannon kind of thing of, we just break things.
Yeah. Oh, you do ask them, what do you want? What are you for? And it's crickets, you know. They don't have a lot of solutions.
Now, the reason why the House, the Senate Republicans said that they were walking out had to do with some procedural issues. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, but then they very quickly owned up to the fact that it was these bills. But there's a very, very old law in Oregon that says that bills must be the description of bills that are read out loud to the legislators needs to be in simple language. And of course, they have to be they're written in legalese for a reason, and specific words have to be used in order to mean exactly what you mean when you're in bill language. And if you read the actual law that they're talking about, they're like, when practicable. So that does mean that, like, if you need to use a legal term, you're going to use a legal term, and it's not going to be quote unquote simple English, right? You know, and so they're basically raising a stink over the fact that the bill descriptions are hard to understand because they have legal words in them, I guess, big words.
Aren't you supposed to know those words if you're in the legislature? One of the things I'm reading about in this book is how Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of the things when she had her committees taken away from her when the Democrats still controlled the House, that she learned from her mentors all these ways that she can stop action on the House floor. And it would be things like having the bills be read in their entirety, things that procedures and processes that just take up a lot of time that usually you streamline unless there's a specific reason to need it. And it was interesting to read how she learned these different techniques, which are just there to basically blast any kind of process.
To obstruct, yeah. I mean, the Senate Republicans from basically the start of this session were requiring bills be read in their entirety. So that was something we've been dealing with all session. Stuff was just moving real slow in the Senate, and Senator Wagner was scheduling, like, you know, floor sessions till 8 o'clock at night because he's like, well, we have to get through these bills one way or another.
This is just one other side. I had a guest on, I think, last year when we were going through some weird stuff with walkouts, and this guest was suggesting that we do away with the Senate. We don't really need the Senate. And I think we don't need the Senate on the federal level. We don't need the Senate on the state level. What do you think about that idea?
I do not have an opinion on that. I think at the federal level, I do have an opinion. At the federal level, I think it is problematic that vast amounts of human beings are erased. Like, representation is erased by the Senate, and it's very tough. Although right now, the Senate is what's keeping things in balance.
But the thing about the Senate that's interesting at the federal level is the Senate is, like, more stable. The House is, I mean, the House went at times from being really, like, radical Democrats, though actually the Democratic Party wasn't quite so radical back when they controlled the House for years and years and years. But then when it would tip to the Republicans, it did become really, really extremely far right. So the Senate is more of a way to keep an equilibrium, and that's the argument for it. But the other part, when you were talking about how it was devised basically to keep the southern states happy, it had a lot to do with slavery.
Yeah.
And so the Senate is really based on the whole institution of slavery and supporting the institution of slavery. One of the other things we really need to look at is our institutions, our political institutions, and which ones are really based on the whole precept that slavery is one of the cornerstones of basically our culture and our government.
Of America, yeah. I mean, in Oregon, I have literally not put a lot of thought into it. I think that the problems we had with trying to get things through the Senate in the more recent past had more to do with leadership style and like, you know, Democrats that weren't really Democrats. And, like, you know what I mean? It's like, I think I don't have a strong feeling there one way or another. But all I know is that, like, I want to kind of go back to the Republican walkout just a little bit, just because I just think it's really important to note. I find it really fascinating that they're doubling down so hard on something that, like, voters from across the state don't appreciate. And you look at the most recent election, they ran a lot of school board members on the parental rights platform. I put air quotes around that, everyone. Air quotes around parental rights, okay? For school boards, and it did not pan out well for them.
Well, actually, as far as I know, only one school district, and I'm disappointed, it was the Gresham-Barlow district, which I think they should know better. They actually elected somebody who was a, quote, parental rights person. But in these really conservative school boards like Newburgh and Canby, where they had been dealing with book banning, mm-hmm. they all flipped. And to me, that says, it speaks volumes.
It speaks volumes. And I just think that I'm just very, the part of me that has to do work at the legislature for a living is like just like, oh God, this is going to be hard. But the part of me who's just like politically curious and likes observing history and seeing what's going to happen is just kind of like, you grab your bag of popcorn and you're just like, all right, how are the voters going to respond to this? You know what I mean? Because it's just like, I don't see how this plays well for them in the long run. And it feels like it really is a short-term strategy for a couple of bills they really didn't like and some hubris around whether or not they can actually overturn this very popular ballot measure. And it's like, and then what, you know, and then what principles are you standing on here? Like what, you know, what, anyway, so it's going to be very fascinating to see how it all plays out. But in the interim, you know, Oregonians need legislators to show up and do their jobs. It's just, this is like really foundational.
I've been thinking a lot, I think because of the age I'm reaching, I start looking at the past a lot, and it's a certain bit of nostalgia. But one of the things that I miss is the Oregon Republican Party in 1970, from whenever up and through the late 70s, because people like Tom McCall was Republican. Hector McPherson, who wrote the original Oregon land use laws, was a Republican. That there were Republicans who might have disagreed with me about logging and some other crucial issues, and a bit about probably income tax and stuff, but that had a basic sense of human dignity. And that actually the Oregon Republican Party, Mark Hatfield is a Republican, mm-hmm. and that the Oregon Republican Party had a way of working truly bipartisanly, and also that they were not against everything good and for everything bad. And I think looking at that shift that's happened nationally and here in Oregon, but here in Oregon, I feel it even more closely, because I think that there were places where the Republican parties, like in Southern California, which spawned Ronald Reagan, were very conservative. But Oregon's Republican Party wasn't. I just wonder what your take on that is, somebody who's come into a political awareness as the Republican Party was really moving to the right.
Oh, but I grew up in Oregon, and I was, you know, I knew why we had public beaches, and I knew that Tom McCall was a very big deal, and I knew that he was a Republican. My parents, until Reagan, had been, you know, Republican. You know, it's like, because you could be, you know, that was when they realized, like, oh, this is not my party, you know, and they're very progressive, you know, people, and they're very progressive now, and I have always been really very conscious of the fact that in the not too distant past, collegiality actually existed. I mean, voters would vote for a Democrat one year and a Republican another, and it was genuinely like if they liked the platform and the person's values, you know, and there was something that happened, and it's like that this polarization is something that's been really, really accelerated since since Reagan. And so for me, I'm at that perfect kind of nexus to recognize a lot of folks in leadership who just really just want to believe that it can be collegial again. And they're in elected office and they were there maybe at some transition time or I don't even know what. But I'm just like, those days are gone. We're not getting them back, you know. And it's like, so I don't know what the new way is of being. But I think a really perfect example of where this – one of the issues that really exemplifies this is this year we were working on a bill that became SB 85, which is the factory farm. It was a factory farm moratorium bill to get a moratorium on factory farming until we can adequately regulate it. And then we weren't able to get a moratorium. And so we started, you know, working on it was going to be a regulation bill that was going to get at like water use particularly. And it was just shocking because most of the supporters of that bill, the strongest supporters of that bill, are farmers from rural Oregon who don't want to be damaged by these big mega dairies and huge chicken farms that are coming in from out of state.
And people in Morrow County
who can't drink their water, right? And Republicans were getting inundated with these like high level touches from real people in their district who were like worried about their livelihood or couldn't drink their water. And they were just, you know, I think at the end of the day, the bill we have now, which has been really, really narrowed down and watered down, has some level of bipartisan support, which is shocking. But the really meaty, like transformative bill that was going to really protect people and water resources. And it left some work to be done. We were going to still have to do a lot of work on air quality and other issues, but it was a major bill. Republicans were just not interested in showing up for their farmers. You know, it was wild. It was absolutely wild. But I think that, you know, like a Tom McCall Republican would have been like, we got to save these farmers. It wouldn't have been even been a question. And they wouldn't have cared if Democrats supported it.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFT, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters about the good, the bad, and the truly awful of this year's legislative session. Well, let's talk about some of the bills that you would like to see pass, and hopefully some way they'll manage to get through the Senate.
Yeah, so there's a group of bills that are about getting at toxics issues. One is updating the Toxic Free Kids Act. We passed one many, many years ago. We were one of the first states to pass the Toxic Free Kids Act to protect children from like toxic chemicals and products. But then we haven't updated it in a very long time, and it's like overdue. We really need to update it. We need to include families of chemicals like PFAS, which are these forever chemicals that are extremely cause cancer. And we just really overdue in updating that. That is in Ways and Means, has bipartisan support. We've got toxic-free cosmetics, which would phase out the worst kinds of toxics from cosmetics, like formaldehyde, which is a weirdly common ingredient in cosmetics that we put on our hair and skin. Oh, my gosh. Really frightening. And also would require disclosure of what chemicals ingredients are in products. So beyond websites, but still, if you wanted to really know what was in your cosmetics, you could go to a website and like look up the ingredients. But it's the phase out that I think is really exciting about that bill of like the worst chemicals. And then there's a toxic-free schools, which is getting at integrated pest management practices. It's basically school districts have been told to do this for over a decade, but we never funded the program, classic Oregon. So this is, let's make sure the schools have the resources they need to be tracking the pesticide use and reducing pesticide use. And so these three bills, I think are really set up to actually move through the building. And in addition to the climate bills we talked about earlier, the building resilience bills, these bills.
There's some other climate bills besides those, aren't there?
There's the resilience hubs, which actually do have bipartisan support, which are all about emergency preparedness, particularly in rural communities. There's some bipartisan support for that bill, also in Ways and Means, because it has a fiscal. Natural Climate Solutions bill, which is about carbon sequestration on our natural and working lands in the state of Oregon. Super competitive for federal money. That bill, like these are all the bills that are just going to be amazing for people, help us compete for federal money, and improve public health, all of the above. There's a drought package that has a lot of incredible, really good stuff in it. These are all the things that are just hanging in the balance that I think have a really clear path.
Now, when Bob Salinger was on a few weeks ago, he was talking about a bill that would remove predator classification for beavers. Now, did that pass already?
I believe it did. Yeah, it's in the Senate. It moved out of committee. It's like ready to go to the floor.
And it actually has a lot of support. It would pass if it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just not 100% sure if it's passed the Senate yet or not. But that's a bill that if it hasn't, would. It shouldn't be hard to pass bills like that, and it shouldn't have taken us this long to define a beaver as a predator species just so that you can kill it. Come on, guys, we can be better than this. But yeah, that bill definitely has a clear path.
So what are some of the bills that you would like to see not pass that are also being held up?
Yeah, so there is a ports bill. We always call it the bad ports bill. One of the quote unquote major threats that Oregon Conservation Network has defined. It was a bill that would allow the original base bill would allow completely override any state and local land use laws for ports to do like major projects. It was bad. It was real bad.
And that bill had some Democratic backing in the beginning.
Oh, all the way through,
yeah,
Barbara.
Actually, I think
it never lost its Democratic backing.
It's been amended a bunch of times.
It's been amended a bunch of times, and the most recent amendment was such a substantial improvement from the base bill and every other version of the bill, because it narrowed it down just to one port, which is in Coos Bay. And that's
where they wanted to build Jordan Cove. I mean, they've already been through that fight for 18 years.
It's not for Jordan Cove. And
no,
I think they're,
it's that same area which does not want to be dredged. That's what's really sad about it.
It's real, but the thing is, we did force, still have to go through a variance process, which is as it should be. Like, if you want to, get around a regulation, you have to ask to get around it and go through a process, right? And you have to go through that. They're going to have to go through a local process as well. It was a substantial improvement, but it could ultimately lead to dredging that, it's a takings, right? It's going to be damaging. It could ultimately lead to something that we all very much would be uncomfortable with, right? So it's still a bill of concern. Folks in the environmental community are very, very concerned about that bill. It's in House Rules. We were expecting it to go to the floor, but it went to House Rules. But that bill, I mean, I'm not, going to lose sleep if it doesn't move. There's a wolf compensation bill that would allow folks who are, raising livestock on the land to get ten times the value of their livestock reimbursed to them if their livestock is killed by a wolf. And that just 7 times is a real big multiplier. We have this program in Oregon called the Wolf Compensation Fund, and it is to help with coexistence. The whole goal is to help ranchers and people coexist with wolves on the landscape. And reimbursing ranchers for the value of their livestock is part of helping with the coexistence. But we view a 7-time multiplier though as that's too much money. so there's 2 different bills. There's another one that says that allows for a 2-time multiplier for specific kinds of livestock. It's in Ways and Means. Ways and Means is, I guess, going to decide whether or not it wants to do any of that. But the 7-time multiplier is a non-starter for us. I really hope that I don't want that. I don't want 5 times. They're gonna have to. So anyway, that's another one of the really problematic bills. There's a number of really problematic bills.
Well, we don't have time to go into all of them.
Yeah.
One last quick thing. If the Republicans don't come back until the very last day of session, and they can do is vote on budgets, when would the special session start, and what do you think would be accomplished in that?
I think that if the only thing on the table, if they come back on the last day, is budget, that they would just do a special session instead. Because the whole point of coming back during session, and this is just me, armchair quarterbacking or whatever it is people call it, this is just my interpretation. I nothing is, who the heck knows what's going on in people's heads. But I think that the power move on the Democrats' part, if they come back for the last day of session, is that they need to pass policies as well. Because right now we have a whole bunch of policies that are ready to go. They've been worked. They've gone through a whole dang process, for goodness sake, and let's get some of these moving with the budget. I think if policies aren't on the table, they'd probably do the budget in a special session, because we don't foregoing all policies while giving Republicans the budget feels gross. If we're going to let go of all the policies, then they're going to own the fact that they killed the session, right? So that's my take, is my interpretation. So I think if that happens, they'd have to have a special session really quickly, because they would need to do some budget things right away. There would need to be a special session no matter what before September 15th if they don't get the budget done, because that's when money actually runs out, in terms of the continuing resolution. So, there could be one in July. God help us.
Well, let's check back. Let's maybe check back sometime in July, and maybe if I have you on, we can do an update on what's really happening. But anyway, Julia, it's great to have you on Locus Focus again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Julia DeGraw with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBGN Radio in Portland, Oregon, satellite stations KBFG up here from KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCUB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kbo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible as we climb out of this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Tank the Tank leaders Nancy Heiser and Sean Looney about their billboard campaign to tank the tanks at the CEI Hub and along the Willamette River. We'll go out with music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh.